You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
He narrowly escaped the killing fields of Cambodia and went on to a life of success and power in Washington. It's not the plot of a novel, but a true story of overcoming overwhelming odds and achieving the American dream. And joining me now is that man, Seashon Siv, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and the author of a memoir called Golden Bones, An Extraordinary Journey from Hell in Cambodia to a New Life in America. It's published by HarperCollins, and it brings Ambassador Siv to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
So what does the title of your book mean, Golden Bones?
In Cambodia, people refer to those who are lucky and blessed, a person of golden bones. And I feel very lucky and blessed to have escaped the killing fields of Cambodia and to have come to live in America.
Well, when we think of the killing fields, we think of bones. Actually, we think of skulls because so many were piled up in extraordinary displays.
That's right.
The term killing fields has come to be associated with the Khmer Rouge regime. Wasn't it coined by your fellow countryman and genocide survivor, Dith Prahn?
Yes, he was a friend of mine. He passed away recently in April, and I've known him since he was in Cambodia working for Sidney Schoenberg. And I think, if you recall, it was Schoenberg's story in the New York Times magazine that sort of generated interest and turned into a movie.
Well, he was here some years back, but I don't remember whether I asked him whether the term killing fields is used in Cambodia, or is it just something that Westerners associate with what happened?
Well, after Prahn started to use that term, it was translated back to Cambodia, to Khmer in Cambodia, and that name became sort of a connotation of what happened to Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge.
Can you clear up all the different names, Cambodia, Kampuchea, Khmer?
Well, Khmer is a term that is used for the people and for the language.
And it was an ancient empire, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Between the 9th and the 15th century, the Khmer Empire was the center of influence in civilization in Southeast Asia. Very powerful, and also it's a term that used to indicate that period when the Cambodia was at the peak of its civilization.
So Khmer Rouge is the Khmer Reds, in effect, using French because Cambodia had a long history in connection with the French. It was a protectorate, and then it was part of French Indochina.
That's correct. And interesting enough, the term was coined by Prince Sihanouk when the Khmer Rouge, Le Khmer Rouge in French, began to revolt in 1968. So he used that term, Khmer Rouge, Le Khmer Rouge. So it sort of became a connotation to the people who were Pol Pot disciples.
And did they adopt the phrase? Did they think Khmer Rouge was a nice name?
No, no, not at all.
So they never called themselves the Khmer Rouge?
They called themselves revolutionaries and so on and so forth.
And what about Cambodia and Kampuchea? Is Kampuchea the real name in Cambodia, the westernized version?
Yeah, Kampuchea is the Khmer word of Cambodia. It's just like the Japanese call Japan Nippon, mm-hmm. or the Germans call Germany Deutschland. But when the Khmer Rouge came to power, they became so nationalistic that they began to use English and French and everything Kampuchea. They call Democratic Kampuchea.
Well, this is similar to what we've seen in Burma or Myanmar,
exactly.
Where people choose to use whatever name they think respects their viewpoint in terms of the country.
That's right. Now, when you say Kampuchea in English to a Cambodian, it became offensive.
Uh-huh.
You may say
because
that
it reminds them
exactly,
of the Khmer Rouge.
Exactly. Because you can say that Kampuchea in Khmer, but when you say Kampuchea in French and in English, it became very offensive.
Now, the Khmer Rouge strike me as atypical of the communist world. They seem more radical than the Chinese Maoists, even during the Cultural Revolution.
That's true.
How did they come to that?
That's true. It's a very good question. I was lucky, or it was privileged to go to China in 1969, the first time. In 1969, it was at the peak of the Cultural Revolution, and I saw the scene at the airport in Canton, which I mentioned in Golden Bones a little bit, and I couldn't believe that this society could go that far, and I didn't believe that it was going to go to Cambodia within 4 or 5 years, but it happened. And like you said, the Khmer Rouge were more radical than any communist society you've seen.
They almost remind me of the Taliban, because their ideology determined almost everything that they did, and it didn't matter whether and there was an inhumane side, because they were so tied to their beliefs.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Many historians argue that the Khmer Rouge was a weak guerrilla force until the carpet bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War gave some legitimacy to the general hatred of King Sihanouk.
I disagree with that notion, because the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese were already in Cambodia in the 60s. They were using the eastern part of Cambodia as sanctuaries. The Khmer Rouge were numbered a few thousand at the beginning, and they were held by the communists in China, the communists in the Soviet Union, and the communists in Vietnam. So it was a creation of the communist branches in Asia. And the bombing that was conducted by the U.S. Air Force in 69 was to target these sanctuaries, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong sanctuaries.
But many innocent people died.
Well, yes.
And Sihanouk, whose greatest evidence of his mandate from heaven was that he had kept his people out of the war, no longer could make that claim.
That's true. That's true. I mean, Sihanouk was the master of tightrope diplomacy. He came to the throne at 18 when Franklin Roosevelt was at the White House. So he tried to be friends of everyone and enemy of none. But it was the outside forces that pulled Cambodia to make a wrong turn of history.
When you started hearing about this insurgency, how much did you and other people know about the goals of what, well, I don't want to call them the Khmer Rouge because they didn't want to call themselves, but how much did you know about the Khmer Rouge's goals?
Very little, very little.
They saying anything? We're going to bring about some incredible revolution that will help everybody?
They were saying that to the remote villages. That's how they recruit people, you know, young, illiterate, ignorant, with all due respect, people in remote areas. But in Phnom Penh and in all the provinces, we had a beautiful life. Cambodia wasn't a poor country. It's not a poor country. The soil is fertile and the water is abundant of fish. So there was no need to go that far to turn the country upside down. And like you said earlier, this ideological connotation was the problem with Cambodia become the land of blood and tears.
And also by turning it upside down, they impoverished the country.
Exactly. They wanted to have an equal society, no rich but only poor people, and that's a problem with their revolution.
My guest is Sichuan Siv, his memoir Golden Bones, An Extraordinary Journey from Hell in Cambodia to a New Life in America. Well, Cambodia is primarily a Buddhist nation, and as I understand Buddhism, it's a belief system based on peace and nonviolence. So how does something as brutal and violent come into being in an environment like that?
That is it's a very difficult question to answer, because I grew up in a Buddhist society. My mother was a very devout Buddhist, and we always learn to be kind to other people, our neighbors, our friends, and so on and so forth. And I just couldn't understand. I mean, nobody could understand why such a gentle society would turn against each other. I mean, it was a Khmer Rouge who turned society upside down. And the only thing I can explain is that you mentioned the weak revolutionary organization. That's probably true, because they were so afraid of losing control of power, so they resorted to all kinds of means, including killing their own people to stay in power.
And a lot of people died. There's a disagreement over how many, but it's in the millions.
It's in a million. I think I've heard that the most conservative estimate was about 2 million people.
You know, when you think of the communist ideal of people gaining power, you have to wonder about how something like this could go so crazy. How old were you when they finally came to power?
In 1975, I was 27 years old already. And
what were you doing?
I was working for CARE, which is a relief organization helping refugees or displaced persons that came pouring into the capital and provincial cities.
And how long did the regime last?
The Khmer Rouge regime lasted for 5 years, from 75 to 79, and then the Vietnamese invaded with 100,000 troops and occupied the country for 10 years.
And one of those, the great ironies of international politics, the United States protested the overthrowing of the Pol Pot regime.
Well, that's, there is a thin line between legality and morality, and I think the United States and other European countries protested the aggression of a foreign power into an independent country. You know, at the United Nations, there is this all principle about non-interference in internal affairs of other state, national sovereignty, and peaceful dispute of settlements, and so on and so forth. But I have to give the United States some credit because when the Khmer Rouge were in power, the United Nations and the whole world were totally silent. There were only five countries. There were only five countries that raised the issue of Khmer Rouge atrocities in Cambodia. There was Australia, Canada, Norway, United Kingdom, and the United States. So we were there at the beginning, and we were one of the voices.
And why do you think more weren't raising their voices?
Because I did not believe that kind of thing happened. My own experience was that when I came out of Cambodia to Thailand in 1976, I was interviewed by a lot of foreign correspondents based in Bangkok, Hong Kong, and so on and so forth. They did five pages of stories in their Asian edition, like the Time Magazine Asian edition. When I came to America in the summer of 1976, I saw a quarter of a page of the same story.
I read that the Khmer Rouge might very well kill you simply because you had eyeglasses, because that would have made you an intellectual.
That's correct.
If you had had a good education.
Mm-hmm.
Were you wearing eyeglasses at the time?
No, because you are now.
No, I
threw away my glasses. I changed my identity. I saw nothing. I heard nothing. I couldn't speak of anything. And I pretend to be a truck driver. That's how I survived under the Khmer Rouge.
How soon before you realized what they were doing?
No, immediately, because my brother-in-law was the head of national intelligence, and he asked me to help translate some captured documents from Khmer into English. And I saw the horror story about the Khmer Rouge atrocities, but I didn't believe it. I thought that, no, the Cambodians wouldn't do anything to fellow Cambodians. But on April 17, when they started walking into Phnom Penh, I immediately recognized their zombie-like attitude, and I said, my God, I hope that the documents I saw wasn't true, but it was.
You also would have been in danger because you had connection to the West,
exactly.
Working with CARE, and,
yes.
And you knew people in the government.
That's right.
And you probably were part of the upper middle class.
Exactly. And the greatest danger for me was my height, because I could throw away my glasses, but I couldn't do anything with my height.
You're too tall?
I'm very tall for a Cambodian, and that created suspicion among the Khmer Rouge that I must have come from a bourgeois family. I was well-fed, et cetera, et cetera. But the irony was that it was my height that saved me when I fell into a booby trap in the jungle of Cambodia, because the punchy stick was supposed to catch the victims at the heart or at the stomach, but they hit me at my legs. So I was saved by my height.
Now, why didn't you just leave right away? There were Westerners leaving, and they were bringing Cambodian friends.
Yes, that was April the 12th, 1975. I was asked to go to the embassy within an hour, but I decided to go to a meeting with a provincial governor because I was responsible for the about 500,000 refugees after all the international staff had left. And I felt that I might be able to go to the meeting to organize the supply. I was able to leave with a clear conscience, but I missed the last chopper by 30 minutes.
And I'm sure you had no idea that you would wind up being one of those refugees somewhere down the line.
That's right.
We'll take a little break and come back with Sishan Sib's story, his memoir Golden Bones, an extraordinary journey from hell in Cambodia to a new life in America. It is published by Harper's. Later in this hour, State of the Union is all about Maine. Find out why the Obama campaign thinks it can count on Maine in November. In the second hour, I'll talk to Francine Prose about her latest novel. And then Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls on language matters. This is WNYC and WNYC.org now. Our entire show is available as a podcast. Sishan Sib is my guest, former U.N. ambassador. He's written a memoir called Golden Bones, An Extraordinary Journey from Hell in Cambodia to a New Life in America, published by Harper. So you didn't escape when you could have. What happened to your family following the power change?
Well, we were forced out of the capital and provincial cities when we were told to go to our native villages. So we went south to my father's native village, and we were split into different family units. I knew that my background would jeopardize my entire family because, like you mentioned earlier, you know, I had a connection with the U.S. I was a college-educated person and so on and so forth. So I asked my mother's blessing that I should leave, and I pick up an old bicycle, and I rode for 3 weeks from the southeastern part to the northwestern part of Cambodia.
You credit your survival to something your mother said to you.
Exactly. When I was growing up, she always told me, no matter what happens, never give up hope. And that was a piece of wisdom that has remained with me.
It's interesting that what they were doing is the opposite of what everybody else seems to have wanted to do. Including the communist countries, which is to modernize. Mm-hmm. They were doing the reverse. They were taking a country that had a diverse economy and trying to make it into an agrarian economy.
And
they were sending people like you into the countryside to work the farms?
That's right. I mean, if they were smart enough to use our talents, our skills, Cambodia would be quite an advanced society because, as I said earlier, it's not a poor country. But their ideological attraction seems so strong that they would do anything to reach their goals.
Didn't you have a visa to go to France?
I did, and I was a little bit skeptical about that. I grew up speaking French. France was my mother country, and my generation, everybody spoke French. But when I got to the camp in Thailand, I learned that it was difficult for refugees to start a new life. And I did not know anybody here in the United States, not even my host family. But I was lucky to be given a visa, and I was lucky to come here.
Yeah, I'm sure you've wondered many times, what would have your life have been like if you'd gone to France instead?
Exactly.
Well, Ho Chi Minh had gone to France, and he wound up the leader of his country.
Yeah.
So maybe something would have happened like that.
I think that's fate.
How difficult was it for you to get to Thailand? You talked about almost being killed in a booby trap.
It was very difficult. I decided that I had to leave because if I stay on, I would die sooner or later.
Were you leaving alone or was your family going as well?
I was alone by myself. I could not trust anybody. I could not believe in anybody. And I just took a leap of faith. It was February the 13th, 1936. I was alone at the back of the timber truck. I jumped off the truck, and I began to walk for 3 days, having nothing to eat and to drink. Then I fell in that booby trap. I was severely wounded, but I arrived in Thailand completely exhausted.
And the Thais, as I understand, were not all that welcoming.
No, they thought I was a Khmer Rouge because I was black. I was dressed in black pajamas. Everybody in Cambodia was dressed in black pajamas. And they were very angry because a few weeks before I got there, there were some clashes along the border, and the Khmer Rouge killed a few Thai people.
Weren't you ordained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand?
I was.
Was that something that you'd aspired to even before you went into exile?
I prayed every night. I pray every night that if I would be able to make it to Thailand and to freedom, I would become a monk. Because in Buddhist society, we believe that every male had to be a monk for a period of time. It's like a rite of passage. And also we believe that if we did something like that, we could earn merits and dedicate our merits to our loved ones.
How long did that last?
I did that for a few weeks. Normally you do it for a few months, but it's more a degree of concentration of your studies that make your stay in the monastery important.
And how did you wind up coming to the United States then?
I was, because of my past association, I was allowed to come here. And my former colleague, a woman named June McNally, who was my supervisor at CARE, she wrote a letter to the embassy telling them to be on lookout for me.
Could you have survived in Thailand?
No, there was not an option to stay in Thailand because you do not want to spend the rest of your life in a refugee camp. And I was.
And you couldn't have just gone out and establish yourself in Thai society.
No, they wouldn't allow that.
And when you came here, you initially wound up in a small town in Connecticut. Were there a lot of Cambodians going there?
No, I was the only Cambodian in that town. It's Wallingford. It's a midpoint between New Haven and Hartford. It's better known for the Choate School. I went there because my host family, they are from there, and I went to live with them. And they have lived in Thailand. They know Asia culture, and I was very lucky to have a smooth transition.
Well, how long did the culture shock last?
It lasts very briefly, but I have to say that I was quite adaptable. That's one of the reasons I was able to survive the Khmer Rouge. I adapted very quickly to new circumstances, and I picked apples. I ate a lot of apples. I cooked hamburgers, and then I came to New York to drive a taxi.
And wound up going to Columbia University.
I was lucky again to get a scholarship from Columbia University.
And that really must have changed your life as well. What did you major in?
International affairs. I was at the School of International Affairs, and I concentrated on international relations.
My guest is Sishan Siv. His memoir, Golden Bones, is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You work for the administrations of both Bush presidents. You were deputy assistant to the president for public liaison for the first President Bush, and also deputy assistant secretary of state for South Asia. How did that come about? That's a big jump from graduating from Columbia University.
Well, there are a few things in between. You know, after graduation, I went to work down in Wall Street. I went to help the Episcopal Church on refugee issues. And I remember in 1976, the summer of 76, I was watching the political conventions on TV, and I didn't understand what was going on. And my host family told me that this is a political convention. These are delegates. They are choosing a nominee, and we are going to vote on the nominees. And they said, look, Sichan, if you wanted to understand this country, especially its political process, you should get involved. So in 1988, I got my chance. I volunteered for the Bush campaign here in New York. I did everything that they wanted me to do. And I was lucky to be chosen among the thousands and thousands of volunteers to be called to serve at the White House.
Well, I've always wondered what public liaison entails. I mean, I do think you probably were better suited for the South Asia position.
Well, public liaison office was founded by Eisenhower in the 50s. It was an office that was used to act as the liaison, or middleman, between the President of the United States and all these special interest groups, you know, public interest groups, the farmers, the truckers, the broadcasters, the bankers, the lawyers, and so on and so forth. And we were there to listen to their concerns and report it to the President. At the same time, we were there to explain to them about the President's policies and position, especially those that concern their constituents. So we were always on the phone, always in contact with people, and I got to travel quite a bit around the United States.
And then entered state
another state, South Asia, was a bureau that was newly created at that time. It includes Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, India, Bhutan, the Maldives, and Sri Lanka. Those are the countries that have been neglected by policymakers, because when you think of Asia, and they always think about Japan and China and so on.
Well, if you're in England, it's interesting. If you're in England and you say Asia, people think of the Indian subcontinent,
exactly.
Pakistan and India, and
that's
maybe
right.
surrounding areas.
That's
and
right.
if you say Asia in the United States, you think of China and Japan,
mm-hmm.
maybe Vietnam.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
And that's perhaps because our histories have been linked in those different ways.
Yeah, we are more connected to the Pacific Rim than to the rest of Asia.
So you worked for the first President Bush. He was in office for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you do during the Clinton years?
I went back to the private sector. I was in investment banking. I was doing a lot of volunteer jobs. I was in volunteering for the Civil Air Patrol, which in this kind of situation, like Gustav and Icom, and they are the ones that were the first to take aerial photography to show to the Department of Public Services of Texas, for example. And so I enjoy doing that kind of thing also.
And when the second President Bush, George W., became president, did you immediately go back into politics?
Yeah, they asked me to go. He asked me to go to Geneva first to work on the human rights issue, and which is an issue that I know quite well from my own experience. So I was there for a brief period of time. When I came back to Washington, he asked me to come to New York.
Now, he has been very criticized for some of the positions that his administration has taken on human rights, both around the world, some of the agreements that the United States has refused to sign, and our own record on human rights. Was that a concern for you? Because you had been a victim of a regime that had tortured people.
No, in fact, we are quite strong and we are quite a leader on human rights issue, because we are the only country that gives country-specific reports on human rights. Everyone is reported every year. And the State Department issues that report. And I myself, when I was in Geneva, I gave country-specific reports, you know, what does Cuba do, what does China and Russia and so on and so forth.
But when people said to you, how can you lecture us when you have Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, you were working for the administration during Abu Ghraib, weren't you?
I was there, yeah. But it's sort of a different issue. We are talking more. When you talk about human rights, you always think about Cuba, Sudan, and Iran, and North Korea. And these countries are what I call the bad and the ugly, because they wanted to be in the Human Rights Commission, not so much because they are so good on human rights, but they want to be there to defend their position.
What was your experience working for the two Bush presidents? Don't father and son have very different management styles?
Well, I mean, in all fairness, they have different style, and I got to know Father Bush better because I was at the White House. Mm-hmm. I saw him day in and day out. So I would say that they do have different styles, yeah.
And you were working more in New York, especially. Well, first in Europe, in Geneva, and
that's
then
right.
at the UN.
That's right, yeah.
After you came here, were you able to learn what happened to your family?
I returned to the Cambodia the first time in 1992 when I was at the White House, because I was at the end of the conference that the French and the Indonesian organized to solve the problem. That was quite an emotional return. But I knew about my family even before in 1980 when I got a letter from a childhood friend telling me that all of them were killed.
Many people who survive when their loved ones have not have feelings of guilt. Did you go through that?
I would rather say that I was lucky. I was lucky. I was blessed because of my mother's love, because of my brothers and sisters' love, and I was a chosen one. But I did not dwell on the past. That what I saw in the refugee camp in Thailand, where people were living in the size of a soccer field, 3,000 of them, they suffered severe mental depression because they sat around all day worrying about the future and feeling sorry about the past. So I just kept on doing things that came my way, the best of my ability, and I was able to go that far. And,
what was it like traveling back to Cambodia? Did it feel like it had changed a lot?
It changed a lot. Golden Bones ends in 2006 when I was able to take my wife to the northwestern part where I lived the final years of my stay in Cambodia in 1975-76. And I was able to retrace my escape route. I was able to find out about the truck driver who saved my life twice and about the mysterious monk who told me to follow the sun and the moon to escape to freedom.
Many people have asked again and again why it's taken so long to punish the people who did this awful thing to their fellow citizens. Do you think that Pol Pot and his cronies got off too easy, and why? I mean, does the younger generation know what's happened? Because until now, there have been no trials?
Well, Pol Pot, for one, got off easily because he died before the tribunal was set up. This is a UN tribunal. And as you know, the United Nations takes a lot of time, a lot of consensus effort to set something up. If one of the veto power, like China, didn't want to have it set up, then you cannot get anything done.
So it was simply China preventing it, despite the fact. What about the Cambodian government? Because Hun Sen had been a member of the Khmer Rouge, then broke with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that he would be a little reluctant to have them talk about his own past.
You got a very, very good point right there. Yes, he was reluctant until a lot of pressure by our friends, Japan and Australia and others, to say that this is the best way to heal a society and that the international community is concerned about it.
Well, the UN has just pledged $1.8 million to support a trial of the surviving leaders.
The U.S., you mean? The U.S., not the UN. The
U.S. I thought it was today's paper. I thought it said the United Nations.
I think the U.S. pledged to the United Nations, oh. Yeah.
So is that something you were working on when you were at the UN?
Yes, we were working on it, and I'm pleased that my former boss, John Negroponte, made the announcement when he was in Cambodia recently.
And what is the relationship between the United States and Cambodia these days?
We have a very good relationship, and amazingly enough, the United States has a very, very high rating among the Cambodians, like 85, 86, 87%, because they began to realize that we do not have any interest except to help them rebuild their society, to help them be on their own feet and moving forward with democratic change and economic growth.
Well, you've lived half your life in Cambodia and half of your life here, maybe a little more here, in fact, than in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see yourself these days as a Cambodian, a Cambodian-American, an American?
I would say I'm both. I'm an ABC, an American by choice. I'm proud to be here, to be an American, but I'm also proud to have a strong cultural heritage, an old cultural heritage.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Sichuan Siv, his memoir Golden Bones, An Extraordinary Journey from Hell in Cambodia to a New Life in America. The book is published by Harper's. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. The pleasure is also mine.
Up next, States of the Union is all about Maine. We find out why the Obama campaign thinks it can count on Maine in November. Also, we'll take a look at how the shrinking shipbuilding industry there is affecting state politics. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.